Okay, so the, I borrowed this from George, is, I mean, either you believe in nonlinear optics or you don't. And if we're not going to use nonlinear optical devices, how can we convince the rest of the world to do it? So the title is Slow Light in Ruby and in Artificial Materials. And I forgot to give my web address here, but let me just tell you that I put all of my talks on my website. I put all of my published papers and all my preprints. So in the unlikely event that you want to know the details of what I'm going to talk about this morning, you can go to my webpage and look for it. And I think it's sort of obvious where to find it. And if it isn't, you could ask.
Could you give us a brief definition of what you mean by artificial
material? Oh yeah, we'll get there. Well, I think you should have come to the first week of this workshop, because I think that was the topic.
You mean metamaterial?
Yeah, metamaterial, yeah. Oh,
okay.
Yeah. Yeah, I'm going to be talking about that. So I really got into this field from my background as a textbook writer and a teacher. I was fascinated by the experiments that many of you in the audience did, and just started compiling them. And then I was asked if I would give a talk at a research seminar in Rochester. And I said, I'm so honored, but why me? These people actually did the work. And I said, well, we'd have to pay them travel funds. So the honest truth is that's how I got into this field, is they asked me to give a review once I'd worked so hard to write a review of this material. I decided to write it, and then it got published in Emil Wolf's Progress in Optics. And there's some copies over here. I didn't know how many to make, so when that pile shrinks to zero, I'll just print up some more copies. I think Dan handed out copies last week as well. So why are we here today? Why are we so interested in slow light? This is a very tricky talk to give, because I'm preaching to the choir in a very real sense. But what is the interest in slow light? Well, at the level of fundamentals of optical physics, this is sort of shaking some of our beliefs. At the level of intrigue, can group refractive indices really be as large as 10 to the 6? I mean, it's just mind-boggling that refractive indices, most of our lives we thought, oh yeah, they can go as low as 1 or as high as 4. And now we're told that no, they can be a million or 10 million or 100 million. We are almost at the point where you could imagine a slow light material and you look through it and you see a window made of slow light material. You look through it and you see what was happening on the other side of the window yesterday. And then you look through it at an angle and you see what happened 2 days ago or 3 days ago. I mean, just our whole conception of what it means, our whole conception of what it means to look through a piece of optical material has differed by these new advances in slow light. We can imagine new devices, optical delay lines, optical storage devices, optical memories. In fact, with John Dowling and Deborah Jackson, who were trying to work on some applications of slow light for synthetic aperture radar, and of course some implications for quantum information, which we heard about in the very last talk. Now, as beautiful as all of your work is, one of the challenges is to find slow light in room temperature solid state materials. And much of my talk today is going to be addressing that specific challenge of how do you do this really in a engineering context. So the outline for the talk I'm going to give this morning, first I'm going to talk a little bit about fundamentals of slow light. In a very crude sense, a rapid review of what's in this review article that Dan Goffey and I wrote. Then talking about some very new results from my laboratory on slow light in Ruby, and then some of our work on slow light in artificial materials or metamaterials. Again, it's so tough preaching to the choir, but the whole essence of why this works and why this is exciting is that the phase velocity is not equal to the group velocity, and that's the whole trick that all of us are exploiting in our slow light research. So let me just spend a few minutes reviewing for you what we mean by a phase velocity, what we mean by a group velocity, and how you make them very, very different from one another. So think of a monochromatic plane wave. We'll represent it in this standard form. And then we all know that the phase velocity is the ratio of the angular frequency omega to the wave vector magnitude k. And using the standard result that k is 2 pi n over the vacuum wavelength, we get this result, that the phase velocity is the speed of light c in vacuum divided by the refractive index. Let's just remind ourselves why the phase velocity is omega over k. Well, the phase of the wave is kz minus omega t, and consequently, points of constant phase move such that in a time delta t, that point moves by an amount delta z, where k delta z is omega delta t. So the velocity is delta z over delta t, or omega over k. You all know that. I mean, we're just reminding you where this comes from so that we can next take a look at group velocity and see how that's different. So to really talk about a group velocity, we should really think about a pulse of light or a wave packet of light. And standard analysis tells us that a pulse will propagate at a different velocity. That's often called the group velocity. And the group velocity is given by d omega dk. I'll remind you why in a moment. And again, if k is n omega over c, you just work out the derivative, and you get this result here. Plug it in up here. You find that the group velocity is c divided by, well, this quantity, n plus omega dn d omega. I will define this to be the group index. Not all of you do, those of us who have been paying attention to the talks given here. Some of you define only the second term to be the group index, but I don't. So you look at this and you say, well, how does the group index standard from the usual phase index? Well, if you propagate through a dispersive medium, that is the situation in which the group velocity will be different from the phase velocity, or equivalently, the group index will be different from the phase index. Now, let's remind ourselves, I mean, that was just mathematical manipulation. Why is it true? Why is it so? And even when is it so? So why is the group velocity given by d omega dk? Well, let's imagine our wave packet propagating through an optical medium, and we want to know how fast does it propagate through that material. Being a wave packet, necessarily, it's made up of a superposition of various frequency components, which I'll represent in this way here. And I tried to draw this in a way to show you that at the peak of the pulse, all of these Fourier components add up in phase at the peak of the pulse. Now, if we want this pulse to remain a pulse as it propagates, we want these components to add in phase for all values of the propagation distance z. If we define, taking our standard definition of the phase, we want there to be no change of the phase with frequency, or that d phi d omega has to vanish. Just differentiating phi with respect to omega, we get this result here, which I can just write as z equals v group times t if we define the group velocity in the standard manner. I'm reminding you of what you learned when you were sophomores, but I think since we're doing research in this, it's maybe worth reminding ourselves how this works. I will now turn to a parlor trick that I was taught by Marlon, but since Marlon didn't use his trick in his talk, I will show it. So this is supposed to represent, I mean, a sinusoidal. This is a monochromatic wave. And here's a monochromatic wave at a different wavelength. And you put them together, and of course, you get some type of interference pattern, which might look like this. If these waves propagate through a non-dispersive medium, both frequency components, both wavelengths propagate with the same phase velocity. So as the light moves through the medium, you get this modulated beam, but it just is moving at a, even the modulation moves at the phase velocity. But now if you move through a dispersive medium, it means that the two frequency components move with different phase velocities. So something like this is happening. And depending on which component moves faster, you see that the group velocity, I mean, even though the phase velocity is clearly positive in this case here, you see that the group velocity is negative even though the phase velocity is positive. Boy, is that a great parlor trick. Every cocktail party I go to where there's one of these, I show that, and it wows the audience.
We had a discussion about similar things in chemistry.
Yes?
We talked about negative refractive index.
Yes.
Because if you do this kind of analysis in a medium that has a negative index, you find that this pattern actually moves in the direction that you would expect from a positive refractive index. So you get a puzzle that it's really not describing the way how it would want to be thrown. It's more of a pattern, it just makes you the impression that what it's going to happen.
I have to think harder about that.
In fact, I think the thing for us to do with those who are not here, if you should look on the web and look at the picture of these MRI plants that were shown by David Kennedy and he shows that for the MRI pattern, positive refraction, you know, which tells a lot of these, in the sense that it bends, you know, away from normal. But the surprise is that the group velocity associated with the pointing vector, which goes in the opposite direction, downwards, away from normal. And so, this answers the criticism of Pendry and his work by the
I love your point of the negative group velocity. I learned this from George, this picture. Mm-hmm. Something I learned from Yuri that I still don't understand, and maybe you can help me understand this, is this business of the group velocity having the minus upstairs dndk term. If I have the...
In my notation?
Yeah, in your notation. Mm-hmm. And in my, you know, freezing light with hot atoms.
Right, but you had spatial dispersion, which I... Should we put this up?
The extra term VG in the bottom right-hand corner...
Yes.
...also times, mm-hmm. right, that the denominator is great.
Yeah.
The numerator has this extra term.
Right.
Minus.
With a minus.
Right.
Isn't that weird?
Physically.
No, I don't either, but that's your... No, I've been told that even what I thought I understand, I don't understand. I certainly don't understand what you understand. So I mean, I cannot comment on why it's a minus sign on the term that isn't here.
Also, I'd like to point out that that Maury pattern shows that the group velocity can go faster than the group phase velocity.
Oh yeah, exactly. Yeah. So I will think more about Ulf's comment, but I need to think much harder.
I think as long as the two phase and the normals of the phase are parallel, then the picture is fine.
It's how steady my hands are. Yeah,
so when
Ron.
You show this at parties, do you get invited back?
Well, I only get invited to parties with physicists, right? So they love it. So actually, I have a lot of material, so let me just press ahead. So if you want to study slow light, you want the group velocity to be very different from the phase velocity. And that means you need very large dispersion. And sort of the obvious thought is that one should study the resonances of an atomic vapor, because near the resonance of an atomic vapor, this dnd omega term can become very large. So that's sort of an obvious thought. And it has some very strong positive implications and some problems as well. I won't go through the details here. You've all been through it a million times in your lives. But if you assume that the number density of atoms is not too large, you can approximate the refractive index as 1 plus 2 pi chi, break n into its real and imaginary parts. These are the two expressions. You plot them here. The imaginary part of the refractive index shows the absorption of a material. The real part of the refractive index shows how the light is slowed down. You actually now, just graphically, take the derivative of this and add it to itself, and this gives you a prediction of what the group refractive index is going to look like. It's going to have this classical form here. But the interesting thing to do, I mean, which I'd done 10 years ago and unfortunately didn't pursue, is to put numbers in. If you just put in characteristic numbers for the width of an atomic resonance, the swing of refractive index that's possible, the frequency of an optical field, you find that this group index has a characteristic swing of something like plus 5 times 10 to the 4th to minus 5 times 10 to the 4th. So this has always been there. This has been in Lorentz's book. The foundations of optical physics say that group indices can be this large, but the whole point is that there's an enormous amount of absorption. So it's very hard to see these effects unless you play some tricks, which I'll get to in a moment. But of course, people who are willing to work very hard become successful. And this is some data of Steve Chu from 1982, where he actually looked at pulse propagation through an absorbing material. And here is the very famous paper. I'm sure everyone here has read it. Here is the pulse delay plotted as a function of the laser frequency as he tunes his laser through a through the resonance line of a color center. This is nitrogen doped into gallium phosphide. These actually show how the pulses change as a function of laser frequency. The data is summarized here. This curve just shows what the absorption line looks like, and this shows that the time delay can either be positive or negative, depending on which, on whether he's tuned to resonance or in the far wings of the resonance. But there was a lot of absorption here that he was fighting. So if you don't want to work as hard as Steve had to work to extract this very weak signal because of all the absorption, you might want to play some tricks. To summarize what I've said up to this point, the group index can be as large as 1 plus omega delta n over gamma. So the tricks you can use involve using nonlinear optics. What you can do is decrease the line width gamma to produce sub-Doppler features. You can also use nonlinear optics to decrease absorption using EIT techniques so that the transmitted pulse is detectable. And you know the story very well. I think the first experiment to demonstrate this effect using the language that we use today was Lena Howe's experiment in a Bose-Einstein condensation, where she saw propagation velocities as low as 17 meters per second. Because this experiment was done in a cloud of ultra-cold atoms, both above and below the transition temperature to a Bose-Einstein condensation, anybody reading this paper superficially would assume that it was the fact that they were using a Bose-Einstein condensation that allowed them to see light that was propagating this slowly. But of course, that's not true. In fact, the order of magnitude calculation I gave two transparencies back suggests that that isn't true. I won't read all the names, but George and Marilyn and Yuri and their large crowd of coworkers were able to demonstrate that they could get ultra-slow propagation even in a hot atomic gas. So the coldness had nothing to do with it. It's playing these EIT tricks that was the real point of seeing very low propagation of light. So that is my just rapid summary of the field and some of the background on slow light. Let me change from a review talk to a discussion of some of my own research in this area. So this is slow light in Ruby. How do we get slow light? Well, we need a very large dN d omega. How do we do that? Well, if we believe in Cramer's Kronig relations, it suggests if you have a very sharp very narrow absorption line, that's the way you get a very large dnd omega. Now, there's a very well-known trick of how to do it. And as the old saying goes, it's very well-known to the very small number of people who know the trick already. You can make use of spectral holes due to population oscillations. This produces hole burning, but a very different type of hole burning. This is hole burning in a homogeneously broadened absorption line. This trick works only if T2 is very much shorter than T1. So just to remind you, the classic textbook example of hole burning says you have an inhomogeneously broadened medium, say a Doppler broadened medium, you apply a very strong laser field. This laser field saturates the atoms, saturates the velocity subgroup that is on resonance with the laser. Consequently, if you measure the absorption profile, you will find something that looks roughly like this with a width of 1 over T2. But there is a quantum coherence effect that is well known to a small number of people that mimics this, but it works even in a homogeneously broadened medium. Of course, it can also work in an inhomogeneously broadened medium, but the point is that it can work in a homogeneously broadened medium, and it produces a spectral hole of width 1 over T1 centered at the laser frequency. So that's the trick that we make use of in our research. And in fact, we were not the first people to talk about this, but we analyzed this pretty completely in a paper we wrote in 1981. And these show, I'll talk a little bit more about the origin in a minute, but this shows numerically some of the predictions. This is the absorption plotted as a function of the detuning of the probe wave from the pump wave normalized by T2. There's a family of curves showing what happens as you increase the intensity of the pump wave. And you see that this little narrow feature gets deeper and power broadens. And you can even find features in which the absorption drops to zero. Now, some people would call this EIT. Some people wouldn't. There are senior members of our community who become apoplexic when I say that this is EIT in a two-level atom. And since I care about Marlin's health, I'm not going to tell you. I'm not going to tell you that this is EIT in a two-level atom. All I'm going to tell you is that it's a two-level atom, and that in the presence of a strong electromagnetic field, the absorption drops to zero. You can reach your own semantic conclusions.
It's a strongly driven two-level atom, which when dressed is no longer a two-level atom.
Yes. Yes. Okay. So, but why does it work? Well, what is the underlying physics that allows this to happen? Well, it can happen either in a simple two-level atom, or in the case of ruby, it is a two-level atom with a trap level into which population decays. A simple redefinition of T1 allows the same theory to apply either to the two-level atom or to this case here. What we imagine is that a strong pump wave and a weak probe wave co-propagate through this atomic medium, and the experiment conceptually is that we measure the absorption of the weak probe wave detuned by an amount little delta. This particular feature involves on a temporal modulation of the population inversion. So let me just define W as the population inversion to simplify the notation. If you solve the density matrix equations of motion for this situation here, you find that approximately the population inversion has a DC component and a component oscillating at this detuning frequency. So the steady state solution is a harmonically modulated solution. The population inversion is driven into oscillation at the beat frequency between the pump wave and the probe wave. And if you look in that paper of mine from 1981, you find expressions for W0 and W of delta, but they're too complicated to really want to show right here. So then you ask, what is the response of the probe beam in the presence of these and the population oscillations are important only if the detuning is less than 1 over T1, which makes a little bit of sense. So you calculate the probe beam response, and you find that there are two contributions. You can have the probe field scattering off of the static part of the response, or you can have the pump wave scattering off the dynamic part of the response. And this, if you then take the imaginary part of the susceptibility, and you find that the probe beam absorption is proportional to a factor that looks like this. This is the background inversion. This is the spectral hole. The spectral hole has a line width of 1 over T1, but shows power broadening. So, I mean, you can work your way through the details, but I think, in essence, this shows the origin of the effect.
Yeah, I like this very much, but if I go back and do a transformation to dress state, Mallow dress state kind of stuff, and then I look at the predicted response vis-a-vis some kind of EIT thinking in terms of phono interference, okay? Mm-hmm. I've gotten rid of the main drive field, so I've got phono interference type EIT in mind. Would I get exactly these results?
I don't know. I mean, that's a very interesting question. I mean, this is right. I mean, you're asking interpretation questions. The Rabi frequency is not enough to power broaden. The dress levels are overlapping. There are some features in the strongly driven two-level atom that can be understood very simply, intuitively, from the fact that you've split the levels apart. Here, you have not split them by T2, but by 1 over T2. So, of course, you can do that, but whether...
But can you understand in terms of out-of-town stuff?
Well, same answer. Of course, you're allowed any... It's a free country. You're allowed any basis you want. But I'm not sure that the bare atom basis isn't as good as any other basis for understanding this. Because the dress levels are... The width of the dress levels is bigger than their separation.
But if I'm trying to be your lawyer and support your contention that this is really EIT, then I should do this little calculation that I've just...
Oh, we should. Okay. We should. I'm trying to convert you.
What I want to know is, do I get $1,000?
I know. No, I'm not a Texan.
At some level, the distortion of the central switches, I mean, if you have two level switches driving very fast, you can also get the negative distortion.
I think so.
What level,
I think when the Rabi frequency becomes comparable to T1 over T2. We can look at, I'm fascinated by these questions. These are things you and I should look at this afternoon. But I want to get done in time that we can have lunch. This feature does not lend itself to intuition. I mean, the grating picture is not the natural way of understanding this. You can understand any, you can develop your own basis. But this is a temporal modulation, not a spatial modulation. I mean, the grating picture of phase conjugation is a beautiful picture, but it doesn't describe this feature very well. You really have to think of population oscillations.
But why aren't the population modulations?
Oh, I think they are, but the beat note is so slow that the spatial variation is bigger than the cell size, I think. Again, these are wonderful questions, but do you really expect me to answer them on my feet? So, as George would know, say, I'm just an experimentalist. you can't, you're not allowed to ask me those questions. anyway, it's for real. Back in 1983, we did the experiment. This shows, we used a modulation technique. I didn't say this. For Ruby, since the T1 lifetime is about 4 milliseconds, the spectral hole has a half width at half maximum, which is what you measure, of only 37 hertz. So it's not real easy to measure a spectral line that's that narrow. So we used a modulation technique. We took a Ruby laser, pass it through an amplitude modulator that impresses two sidebands on the laser, and then we measured the degree of attenuation of those sidebands. So this shows the attenuation of the sidebands as a function of modulation frequency as we increase the laser power. Up here, there's no saturation. Up here, you see this 37 hertz wide hole. The hole gets deeper, and then it begins to power broaden. And I think when the power broadens to the T2 line width, that's when it actually goes negative. So that thought lay dormant for like 20 years until the field of slow light got invented. And then it occurred to me that, this is exactly the type of system in which we can see slow light in a room temperature solid state system. Phil Hemmer is going to be here either tomorrow or the next day. He's also working on slow light and solid state systems, and I'd just be fascinated to compare these results with his technique. I think he's working on rare earth transitions. So there are some similarity and some differences. But RX, so there are some experiments that are technically difficult, but the theory is straightforward. This is just the other way around. It's a ridiculously easy way of producing slow light. You just have to know about this very strange quantum interference effect I just described to you. So again, we take an argon ion laser, pass it through an electro-optic modulator. We either extract a Gaussian pulse from the argon laser, or we can put sinusoidal modulation on the laser. We've done both of those experiments, and I'll report them to you in a minute. We then take the beam, we focus it into a 7 centimeter long ruby laser rod, and look at the power that's transmitted through the laser, and we split them off for a reference, and we store it on a digital oscilloscope. There's always some speckle. There's always some speckle, and you'd rather put so much speckle on the beam that the central limit theorem comes to your rescue than to have an amount of speckle that changes with the modulation frequency, and that messes up the signal to noise ratio of your detected signal. But it's a fairly standard trick. I mean, if it can't be perfect, just make it random. This shows some of the data. This is still work in progress. We have not submitted this, but we hope to do so very soon. So this is Gaussian pulse propagation through the ruby. This was a pulse that was 20 milliseconds in duration. The input pulse is the solid line. The output pulse is the dashed line. Just to look at it a little bit more readily, we've taken the peak here and blown it up here. And you can see that there is a 512 microsecond delay between the input and the output. And that converts to a velocity, group velocity, of 140 meters per second, or a group index of 2 times 10 to the 6. And there's very little pulse distortion here.
That's fantastic. And this is room temperature.
Room temperature.
That's great.
I'm rather proud of myself. But you're not supposed to say that, are you?
You're proud of you, too.
We hope so. We hope so. We hope so. That's for the next conference. That's how I get invited back. Maybe I'll get an invitation to PQE.
Yeah, right. You already have.
Well, then I don't have to do the experiment. You know, who wants to work that hard? To answer your question, Ray, ruby shows hole burning. Alexandrite shows anti-hole burning. Instead of saturation, it's reverse saturation. Just take everything I said and put a minus sign in front of it. That'll be the... The line width is broader, so my guess is that the effect will have the opposite sign, but the group index will be 10 times lower. But still worth doing. More quantitatively, we've put a harmonic modulation on the beam, And that allows us to see how different Fourier components get delayed as they propagate through the material. Solid lines are theoretical predictions. We've done it for 0.1 watts and for 250 milliwatts. And the curves look like this. There's good agreement between the data and the theoretical predictions. And we get delays as large as about 1.2 milliseconds, which corresponds to a velocity of 60 meters per second. So it's not better than what anyone else has done, but it's so much easier. I mean, who wants to?
Why isn't there a plateau at low modulation frequency? Is the delay constant below a certain?
It does. I guess these curves would. That rollover is within 37 hertz of the origin. So we're not done yet. I guess at least aesthetically we're not done. We should also show it on a scale that goes from zero to maybe 100 hertz, which would show that roll off. Did I say, Lorentzian? But it's still Lorentzian. How much time do I have left? Okay, good. I'm two-thirds done now. We're still working on this. And the very last topic I want to tell you about is slow light in nanostructured devices, which really would fit in perfectly with the first week of this workshop, that you can't be in two places at once. Well, who knows now with quantum information and all that. So this really fits in so well with the first week of the conference. I guess if I were out of time, I would show you this. This tells the whole story, and then I could just sit down. The idea is obvious, but we're actually building them, and we're very close to having results on this. So we call it a scissor. It's a side-coupled integrated space sequence of resonators. But as you might guess, we came up with the name first and the significance of it after the fact. We have an optical waveguide that is evanescently coupled to a sequence of ring resonators. So the light comes down the waveguide, it couples into one of these resonators, circulates maybe 100 times, 100 being the finesse of the resonator, leaks out, comes in the next resonator, this one. So the light goes slow for a very obvious, almost mechanical reason, that the light spends more of its time spinning its wheels than it does going from one device to the next. So this device displays slow light, tailored dispersion. What do I mean by tailored dispersion? As you tune from one side of resonance to the other, the amount of slowdown depends very critically on the detuning, because these are very sharp resonances. So the dispersion is very much frequency dependent. These devices are also highly nonlinear, so they display optical solitons. At least in the continuum limit, we can describe this device by a nonlinear Schrodinger equation, so it's not at all surprising that it shows soliton solutions. Just one simple example, I'll get to that in a minute. It's the intrinsic nonlinearity of the material enhanced by the fact that it's a resonance structure. So it's an enhanced nonlinearity, and I'll get more explicitly to that in a minute. It's an all-pass filter. It's an optical all-pass filter. It passes all frequencies, but it puts a highly frequency-dependent phase shift on each frequency component. All the light gets through, but with a very strange phase relationship.
It violates?
No, I said. I heard him wrong, so I got to repeat. I heard him wrong, repeat. So it. Oh, I see what you, Well, Kramer's, well, we, that, that's another one to talk about. Kramer's Kronig is usually the real and the imaginary parts. We'd want to look very carefully. I'm not going to throw the... But we usually don't do Kramer's Kronig for amplitude phase.
What you're doing is you're analyzing the whole resonance structure.
Yes.
And then this theory is simply not applicable.
You could violate one of the assumptions underlying KK, like single variant risk, and so on.
Can you answer the question?
Yeah.
You're not saying this is a negative index, are you?
I haven't yet, not yet. Not yet, but I will. And since I'm talking to a sophisticated audience, ignoring loss, it cannot be a negative index. If you add loss to the analysis, then it turns out that you can get superluminal propagation. I forget if it's n negative or n greater than c, but this device will give superluminal propagation, but only in the lossy case for technical reasons that we published already in PhysRev E about 6 months ago.
You're coming to the experimental layout.
Yeah, in a minute, yeah. This is obvious, but this is to whet your appetite, that very weak pulses are just going to disperse as they propagate down the device, but more intense pulses can propagate as solo fans. That's just the introduction. And now the details. Actually, we got into this by a joint project, John Huebner and myself, graduate student with Dick Slusher at Lucent. And the idea was to build ultra-fast all-optical switching devices. So the implementation with Dick Slusher is in chalcogenide glass, actually arsenic triselenide. We have a waveguide here. In with Dick, we're just thinking of one resonator. So again, light sneaks into the resonator. This is a finite difference time domain simulation of how the device works at the level of Maxwell's equations. You see that the light builds up to a higher intensity inside the resonator than outside. That's how resonators work. You see that all of the light is transmitted because there's no other output port. That's why it's an all-pass filter. There's no place for the light to go except to be transmitted. Now, why is this a good idea? Or why do we even hope it's a good idea?
Why am I seeing bright, dark, bright, dark?
Oh, those are optical, that's an optical wavelength. This is at the level of Maxwell's equations, so that is actually a half wavelength of optical light.
I understand that it's standing waves, but isn't it all traveling waves?
It's traveling waves.
So how am I, is it a snapshot?
It's a snapshot, It's a snapshot. If you calculate the nonlinear phase shift that the light will experience in going through this device, it scales as the square of the finesse of the resonator. We're thinking of a finesse of about 100, so the total enhancement of the nonlinearity would be 10 to the fourth. Nothing to sneeze at. We're assuming a Kerr nonlinearity. We're actually building these devices in chalcogenide glass with Dick Slusher in my own laboratory in gallium arsenide. And we thought about doing it in doped polymers. Why the square of the finesse?
What's the size of it?
Oh, 10 microns in diameter. I mean, think of this as about a micron here, because these are whispering gallery modes, so the light is confined to about a wavelength.
So what is coupling between the ring and the...
Okay, evanescent coupling.
But how big is it?
I learned that from you, right? If the finesse is 100, the coupling is about 1%. I mean, it's just like it's any other Fabry-Pérot theory. It's actually a Giroux-Tournois interferometer, or it's more analogous to a Giroux-Tournois because there's only one output port. Why the square of the finesse? Well, because the intensity is higher on the inside than it is on the outside, but the light makes many passes, and those are multiplicative effects. So I think this is a good idea. I mean, it's a way of enhancing optical nonlinearities. The particular device that Dick and I are talking about making would be a standard nonlinear Mach Zehnder, two input ports, two output ports. You couple one arm of the interferometer to one of the ring resonators, but you don't couple the other arm. Because of that, the light going through this arm experiences a much bigger nonlinear phase shift than the light going to this arm. And depending on the relative intensities of the two inputs, you can route the input to either of the two output channels. So that's what we're trying to do. Why are they called whispering gallery modes? Sorry. It's because the theoretical analysis of an optical whispering gallery mode is very much analogous to the analysis of the whispering gallery mode in St. Paul's Cathedral that Lord Rayleigh worked out 100 some years ago. And I love to tell my program monitors that I did not spend even one dime of federal monies to send myself to London to take that picture. Marlon has his anthrax detector. I have mine. And I mean, honest, we were working on this before September 11th. This is a DARPA-funded project. So the idea is take the disk resonator, put a binding layer of some antibodies on top of it, so something like an anthrax spore will selectively bind to the upper layer of the disk resonator. That introduces a loss mechanism. Why is this plausibly a good idea? Well, the fact that the light circulates 100 times sort of magnifies the influence of the absorption by a factor of 100. So we can measure absorptions that are 100 times lower than what one could ordinarily detect. This shows an extreme example of what we're trying to accomplish. In the absence of the pathogen, you see all the light goes through. In the presence of the pathogen, the transmitted intensity drops to zero. Zero? Well, because, just think of it, the output here is the linear superposition of some light coming directly down the waveguide and some light that's coupled out of the ring resonator. This is sometimes called critically coupling, that if you get the transmission properly, it's impedance, yeah, thank you, it's impedance match. So with exactly the right value of the coupling, you can find a situation where the presence of one pathogen on the device will lead to a vanishing of the output. So optical, logical one, logical zero. One anthrax spore drops on it, the intensity drops to zero. So in a broad sense, I'm repeating myself now, but what we're trying to do here is to exploit the ability of micro-resonators to enhance nonlinearities and induce strong dispersive effects for creating structured waveguides with exotic properties. So we are trying to build in the laboratory materials or structures that have optical properties that are qualitatively dissimilar to anything that occurs in nature. And I'm just repeating myself a little bit here, that you can time resolve the propagation of light through the structure, but it's sometimes much easier to work in a continuum description. So if you take a distance scale large enough to encompass many resonators, you can go to a continuum description and describe this in terms of a nonlinear Schrodinger equation of the form shown here, which of course has many solutions, including the fundamental soliton solution. How do solitons work? Well, they work by a balancing of dispersion with nonlinearity. The nonlinear response has this functional form here. It peaks up at the cavity resonance frequency. Beta 2 is the group velocity dispersion parameter. I'm using the notation of fiber optics now. This has the form shown here. And you see that beta 2 can have either a positive or negative sign. So these devices give you extraordinary control of the optical properties. You can even change the sign of beta 2 just by tuning your carrier frequency to one side of resonance or to the other side of resonance. So the way you get a soliton is you just choose an operating frequency where you get a balance between the nonlinear coefficient and the dispersive coefficient. I've already said that the resonator can enhance the intrinsic nonlinearity of the material by 3 to 4 orders of magnitude. If you put numbers in to ask, well, how dispersive is this? It turns out that these devices are something like 7 orders of magnitude more dispersive than silica glass. So beta 2 is 10 to the 7th times larger than that of optical fiber. You say, how can that be? Well, remember how optical fiber works. There's the material contribution to the dispersion, and there's the waveguide contribution to the dispersion. Here it's the waveguide contribution that's overwhelming the material contribution to the dispersion, and that's why the dispersion can be this large. So I've already shown you these two pictures, that a weak pulse would simply disperse, but that a soliton can propagate down the structure without any dispersion of the pulse. Just let me point out what the numbers are for this case I'm thinking of here. This would be resonators with a 5 micron diameter, a finesse of 30. The entire structure might have 100 resonators spaced by 10 microns, so the total length of the device is 1 millimeter. So this is one of the reasons why I'm so excited about this. In an optical fiber, the characteristic length over which solitons form is something like a kilometer. Because the dispersion is so much larger and because the nonlinearity is enhanced, the distance scale for soliton formation, for the dynamical evolution of soliton, shrinks from a kilometer to a millimeter. So, if we pull this off, it would be very nice. I think it would be so far away from the conditions for a soliton in the optical fiber that it will propagate in the linear regime. I think dispersion dominates. Oh, and again, because we can change beta 2 from positive or negative just by tuning from one side of resonance to the other, the same physical structure can support either a bright soliton or a dark soliton. So how are we building these? I want to ask, how are you going to build them? So over the past year, I've become very fascinated with nanofabrication. I tell people this is my midlife crisis. Most people my age take a mistress. I discovered nanofabrication. So this is my thing. It's an entirely new direction for me. I actually go into the clean room myself and help the students make these devices. At a conceptual level, we sometimes distinguish between materials, even artificial materials, and devices. But if you build something in which the structuring is on the scale of a wavelength, it begins to blend the distinction between what you mean by a material or a device. I think that's a very exciting regime in which to be working. So this is what we're actually building at Rochester. This is things we're doing with our own hands. So this is a side view. This is a top view. Here is the disk with a 10 micron diameter. Here's the optical waveguide. We flare the waveguide out at the ends to make it easier to couple light into the waveguide at one end and out of the waveguide at the other end. The critical dimension is this gap dimension here. The dimensions are microns, so we want to maintain this gap dimension at about a tenth of a micron or 100 nanometers, and we think the tolerancing would be about 10 nanometers. So people say, why do you call it nanofabrication? Well, certainly the tolerances on the construction of these devices are very much in the nanometer scale. The vertical patterning is done by an MBE growth. We have an MBE machine in Rochester. So this structure is grown by Gary Wicks for me in Rochester. The transverse patterning is done at the Cornell Nanofabrication Facility. It's a user's facility. They have to let me use it, leaving aside the fact they probably want to let me use it. But it's a user's facility. We go down there and build these devices. I won't go through the details. Now that you've asked your question, you see you really don't want all the details of the answer. But in rapid summary, we take our structure, we put in a oxide layer and a PMMA layer. We use an E-beam to write the pattern into the PMMA. Then through two stages of etching, we transfer this pattern into the gallium arsenide structure itself. So, I mean, this is the technique that we are using for the fabrication.
Why do you use E-beam? Wouldn't green light be just as well?
Roughly, I mean, there's E-beam lithography, there's photolithography. If you want to build one of a kind, E-beam is easier. If you want to build millions of them, you want to use photolithography. With photolithography, you build a mask, which is really tough, and then you can duplicate it many, many times. We're not in the production stage yet. So E-beam lithography is the preferred way for us to proceed. My irreverent name, this is the first thing we ever built, so I call it a nonlinear optical loop-de-loop. I think you can do better with E-beam. Yeah, you can do better with E-beam. We're at the point where we could probably, we maybe could do it optically. So for the particular things we're doing, the decision was based that it's easy, if you're building one of a kind, you do E-beam. So this is the first thing we built, and I was there, I mean, I was there helping the student build it, so I'm very proud of this. Although this is just, this is written into the PMMA resist. So this is just the very first stage of the fabrication process. This shows that we've been able to write much more complicated structures as well. I mean, here's even our Mach-Zehnder interferometer with a waveguide, with a resonator coupled to it. Next step is you transfer that pattern into silica. Silica is a much more robust material than PMMA. So this is an AFM picture showing that we have successfully etched the pattern into the silica mask. This is the waveguide here. This is the disc resonator. On this scale here, you can just barely tell that there's some curvature here.
So, AFM?
Atomic force microscope. And these are the final devices. So these are the actual devices as patterned into the gallium arsenide AlGaAs system. So the talk is going to end abruptly. It's a progress report. We have built these devices. As of this moment, we have successfully injected light into one end and got light out the other end. We are still in the process of characterizing the devices, looking for nonlinear effects, and looking for dispersive effects. We are working on that. Believe me, John Huebner wants to graduate, and there's nothing and the only thing holding him back is getting some characterization of these devices. So, boy, this is an exciting field, and I thank you for inviting me to come and talk to you. And I mean, I share your excitement about how much fun this is. So thank you. Yeah, well, a lot of people. Right now, we're at the point we can't even quantify that. We'd have to know how much we injected into one end to know what fraction came through. And even that's very tricky.
We call it the OPAP, in the whole that's 100%
OPAP. Oh, yes.
But nonetheless, if you look carefully, it's a 50 meter distance
structure. Right. Yeah, we're very worried. Well, that's a great concern. I mean, there are fundamental losses. Whispering gallery modes are not truly bound modes. There's always some intrinsic leakage. The intrinsic leakage is so small. Well, I mean, if you made it a micron diameter, then the intrinsic leakage would be very important. If you're building them 10 microns in diameter with 1 micron light, the intrinsic leakage is very small. surface scattering is likely to be the dominant loss mechanism, and we're very worried about it. People have built these, so.
Concerned with the leakage, the top corner of the fifth, where there's going to have a large abrupt change of index, and it's very corner.
I'll think about that. For ease of computation, we do two-dimensional models. So that finite difference time domain simulation was a two-dimensional one. And the physical point you're concerned with is something we have almost not addressed. People have built these, maybe not 100 of them, but people have built ring disk resonators with a finesse of 100. So it's within known capability to do it. Yeah, Herb.
Solid tone simulation includes power levels of critical one.
I wasn't even paying attention, but
what kind of nonlinearity are you using?
I think that was for which part of the talk? Just like five slides back.
Yeah, about five slides.
That was either, that's published now. It was either chalcogenide or gallium arsenide, but they're not all that different. So that was with the factor of 10 to the third, say, enhancement, but using the actual value of chi 3. Then we were really working very strongly with Dick Slusher, so I think it was chalcogenide.
Mm-hmm. Is it really a metamaterial in the sense of a negative refractive index?
Oh, right. No. No, not at all. Not at all.
Okay.
Not at all. We have found some exotic situations in which the group index we found superluminal propagation, but it's not a meta. I wasn't here the first week. I didn't know what. We have definitions already. No, it's not a metamaterial. The phase index can never go negative.
And one thing on that, those experiments in the Ruby and the solar light, you thought about throwing your piece of Ruby on a track with the lights and you could actually say it's going to be zero, stop it.
No, well.
For as long as.
The Rube Goldberg version of the. Yeah. Yeah, you could do that. Or you could say we've stopped it in some other reference frame. No, but you want it to be the yeah. That's not.
Why can't run by it? Well, I can't run 60 meters per second.
Yeah, that might be worth doing. If we'll see how the referees like this. If we have to go to these heroic extremes to get the paper into a named journal, then we'll. Accelerate our Ruby to those speeds.
I might just remark that what we're doing now is shooting scattered atoms into our pulse and seeing within the next month we will that the pulse is stuck.
So you don't have the problem of the front and back edge of your crystal?
Right? No, because our atoms move at different velocities at different parts in the jet. So it gets in okay, and then at some point it finds the atoms moving at just the right speed.
Are you sure that
it's going to stop? Well, one time I heard Vicky Bradstock said, I'm not sure of anything. And so I would say that. But I think it will. Maybe
80% confidence level. Yes, Alexi.
Oh,
yes. Mm-hmm. Nothing. Nothing because we've also thought about building devices that look like this. In which case the periodicity would be very important because there's no feedback. Because there's no feedback, the periodicity is not important at all.
What about the appearance of the waves when you travel 100 times an hour?
Well, that's the intrinsic. That that's a question of the resonance structure of a particular ring. Now, there's an issue of inhomogeneous broadening. If the different rings have different circumferences, then the resonance of one won't be exactly the same as that of the next. And that's another concern. I mean, people are saying, have you worried about this? Well, we've worried about everything you've said and more. But the periodicity is not an intrinsic concern for any of this.
I just want to get into the catalog of Pearl Writer Fest. Blood Curries has seen, very narrow meteorological resonance.
Mm-hmm.
Right, yeah.
Yeah.
In terms of meeting the base in another scenario.
Mm-hmm.
And what? Can I ask another question about these structures? Can you think of anything similar using existing fiber technologies, fiber couplers, maybe make a fiber splitter and loop it around?
Something similar to this.
Yeah,
we, in fact, the first paper we wrote, we were thinking of doing that. And then we tried to do the experiment, and we realized that even with bending radius is what they are, the resonance of a ring, of a fiber, is so narrow that it was an almost a superhuman effort to, we'd have to phase lock our lasers to that resonance. And then we started thinking, well, this is more significant and maybe easier. So that's on the back burner. But we started working on that and then realized that nobody wants a resonance that sharp. At least not for telecom or for some of the engineering applications that we have in mind.
All right, so my question is,
thank you.